Greetings, I'm James Gillen, your host, and we've got another great show. We've got Joel Garbin on the show, and he's the president of the nonprofit New Energy Movement, and you can go check that out at www.newenergymovement.org. We'll have those up on the site for you. And he's also he co-authored with Gene Manning a book called Breakthrough Power, How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World. And that's also at www.breakthroughpower.net. And rather than reading a really long bio, Joe's been with us for quite some time. He's been, I don't know when he first came to the ranch, maybe he can tell us that, but he's been a regular here and he's seen all the UFO activity and all the other crazy things that happen here. But without any further ado, I want to go ahead and bring Joel on the show. Are you with us?
Yay. Hey, James, this is Joel. Yeah, happy to be here.
All right. Great to have you on the show again.
Well, I heard you mention when did I first come up and see what you have going on there at the East City Ranch. And as I recollect, it was, late November in the year 2000.
Okay.
So going back a ways, it's amazing how fast the time passes. But it's been an incredible ride. since 2000, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. You know, I have a picture of you at the ranch, and you're sitting in a chair, and this orb is above your head, and, you know, and I'm pointing at it, kind of looking at it. It's an amazing picture, and this orb looks like a dolphin.
Right, right. I remember that very distinctly. In fact, that I have the original pictures that were taken from that. We had it was kind of an interesting story of how I even came to meet you for the first time and then, have that experience there on your ranch. And would you like me to tell the story real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, I had gone down to a conference down in Berkeley to hear, some of the folks who are researching various aspects of new science tell what their latest findings had been. And while I was down there, I had a very synchronous meeting with a gentleman who had gone to the same university where I did back in Ohio at Miami University. And just I had heard him speaking to a group of men there off to the side during one of the breaks in the conference. And I heard him speaking about free energy, which, of course, that's what I've devoted myself to through the New Energy Movement and our book, Breakthrough Power. But we had a chance to go to lunch together, and this gentleman and I were kind of exchanging stories on various things. And he said to me, then he said, hey, you live in Portland, Oregon, and I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but there's this amazing place not too far from you where they're routinely having UFO sightings and a lot of pretty dramatic sightings. And he said to me, well, would you like the name of the fellow who owns the ranch? And I said, well, yeah, that sounds pretty interesting. And I said, my main thrust is the implications of free energy that might have to do with propulsion across star systems and or time travel or things like that. Clearly, there would be exotic energy sources that would be involved in that. So I already at that time had well accepted the idea that the universe is rich with life and rich with intelligent life. And from my early childhood, I'd had some of my own experiences of some pretty dramatic UFO sightings that were occurring in the Midwestern United States in the early 70s. I grew up on an apple farm outside of Cincinnati, Ohio, and my family and I had a very dramatic sighting one night in a summer while we were just having a backyard barbecue. And my father was very open-minded to these types of things as well. He was curious. He had a tremendous library of books, some of which explored exotic science topics, including the UFO topic. So I always had parents who were, relatively open-minded on things, even though they were quite conservative people. But when the gentleman at the Berkeley conference had referenced you, I just said, well, okay, I will follow up on this. And, you know, myself being a scientist, I feel it's important that when there's some compelling information that I don't really want to just take someone else's word for it. I want to go investigate myself, have my own experience, be able to speak intelligibly with the other researchers and from my own feet and hands, having gotten wet in whatever it was that, you know, the experience is about. So I wanted to do that with your ranch as well. So when I got back to Portland, I happened to mention to five people here in Portland who were very close to me, and I said, hey, you know, I heard there's this UFO hotspot, if you will, that's just, you know, right up the river there, just north of Hood River, which is about an hour and a half's drive from my home. And I said, would you be interested in going up to this place if the owner, you know, extends such an invitation? And to a man or woman, which was the case in two instances, everyone, the first six people who I mentioned this to, said, heck yeah, you got to take me with you if you're going to go do this. So I found that very, very validating. So that's when I first called you, James, and I remember it being there in mid-November of 2000, and you said, hey, you know, come up next Saturday, and we'll have, you know, we'll go out and do a sky watch and see what happens. So my little party, we caravan on up that following Saturday, and, you know, it's late November, it's cold weather. In fact, when we start to get up in elevation toward Trout Lake, it was starting to snow. And you know, we'd brought, you know, cold weather gear with us. You know, we all had parkas and you know hot drinks and thermoses and all that kind of stuff, because I figured that, you know, we'd be outside. But we went, you know, came up to your place. You greeted us very warmly, you know, talked to us a little bit about, you know, what the ranch is about and what some of the activity had been there, but not in great detail. And, you know, my interest was in being out there in that field and trying to see something. But the weather was really pretty lousy. It was, you know, this kind of, totally overcast and kind of a misty, wet type of snow coming down. And there already were probably, there must have been probably a half a foot of snow or more already on the ground. So, you know, we're sitting out there, you know, in our little camp chairs and things, you know, hoping, you know, maybe that something was going to buzz by very dramatically. But you know, I think you were pretty practical about things. You said, hey, this doesn't look very good as far as sighting conditions here, because, you know, the weather was totally overcast. So you said, hey, why don't you come on into the ranch house? I'll kind of show you some of the archives that you had developed over the years, which included a lot of, you know, still photos and films and things. So our whole group came in. You gave us an orientation to the records that you had there, and it was fascinating. And I really gained a lot from the material that you already had assembled, but also it was really interesting to see the personal perspectives that you brought to this. And you know as a scientist, you know, I was interested in what I guess I would consider the data, and certainly you were showing us data and some evidence, but I also found it just from a pure social and you know, kind of man to man view, that you had a very holistic perspective on what the meaning of this was. And that moved me quite a bit, because it was evident that you weren't constructing any, certainly no scientific dogma around the experiences that you'd had at the ranch, but you also weren't trying to construct, you know, any type of, oh, what should we call it? You know, any philosophical or spiritual dogma around what might be going on as well. You definitely kept it open. Like, hey, you know, we only know a bit of this. Maybe a few layers of the onion had been peeled back, and you'd had the privilege to see some of this. But, you know, but I personally felt like I could resonate strongly with you because you had a very open mind, and, you know, you definitely weren't, you know, trying to pretend to be, you know, the know-it-all of this topic. And I found that, you know, very, very refreshing. So after you showed us a lot of, you know, the information there that you had in the films and things, and I think everyone was pretty moved that, whoa, you know, there's definitely something here, and we were really excited to get back out there in the snow and see if maybe the sky had cleared up a little bit. Well, we went back out, and I remember there was actually just a few of us that went out this time, and we just were out there for a few more minutes, and you said, you know, this still isn't looking very good. And you said, let's try something else. And I said, what do you mean? And you said, let's try a clearing meditation, which I knew what you meant by that. But my best friend from Portland, you know, one a fellow named Mike, great guy, but very much, you know, kind of, oh, I guess I would say, you know, very much feet on the ground, with very minimal exposure to anything non-conventional, let's say. You know, Mike was like, what are you guys talking about? A clearing what? A clearing meditation? What do you, you know, what is that? And I just said, well, let's just go and let's just be open to an experience and see what happens here. I said, clearly something interesting is going on here. So, you know, we went into your ranch house, and actually, of the six of us that were up there that had come up for this, five of us were experienced meditators. In fact, two of those who came up, my friends Rich and Pam, you know, Richard had taught meditation for over 20 years, and, mm-hmm. and his wife Pam also was very experienced, and then a couple of the others as well. My friend Mike hadn't, and he was just like, well, I'm just going to watch and observe and just kind of see what goes on. So we had, you know, meditated for probably 15 minutes and held the visualization that the sky was going to clear out there and that maybe we were going to get to actually see some type of activity up in the sky. So we go back out there and sit down in our chairs, again, just sitting out there in the snow. Now it had stopped snowing, and I was very, very curious because my same friend Mike, who was a bit, I guess it's fair to say he was a bit skeptical on the clearing meditation exercise, he all of a sudden just like grabs me by the shoulder, and he goes, oh, my God, look at that. And I said, what? And literally right above us, this perfect circle just appears in the clouds. And that perfect circle just keeps growing and growing and growing. And just this amazing, you know, perfect cutout in the cloud. And Mike, who actually does have some skill in when it comes to astronomy, He says, oh, my God, look at those stars right there, the first stars that appeared in that hole. And I said, what? What are they? And he says, you're not going to believe this. I said, what? And he said, those are the Pleiades. And of course, you had made very frequent references to the Pleiades when you were giving us the background and reviewing all the materials, you know, inside the ranch house there. So that was a pretty cool moment there. Well, one of the other who were with us, one of the women who was an intuitive, she all of a sudden jumps up. She says, hey, I feel like there's something here, and you corroborated that. And she starts taking pictures all around the field and pictures around our group. And shortly after, we heard this very unusual sound that, you know, as someone who grew up on a farm, spent a lot of time in the woods in this, I'd never heard anything like this. It sounded like a very large flock of birds is the best way I could describe it. You know, just from the standpoint of hearing the sound of like kind of a, you know, how birds kind of squeak and squawk and twitter. And if it's a very large flock that's near you, you can actually hear the wing beats in that. It was a sound that was a combination of a lot of those types of audio effects, but it wasn't birds. Clearly, it was something very unusual. That as I turned to Mike, who again, you know, had spent a lot of time out in nature and all that. I mean, neither of us had, you know, could pinpoint anything that was quite like this. But that sound was moving very rapidly. So it would be way out in front of us, like from your normal, where at that time you had kind of the viewing platform built out there in the field. You didn't have a lot of the other buildings that you have there now, but, you know, where we're there and facing out toward Mount Adams, we could hear this sound just like moving around, like way out there in front of us, and then all of a sudden, in an instant, it would be, you know, way, way, way over to the right tree line, and then in another second, it was way, way, way over to the left, over, you know, toward those farms, way over there on that side of the property, and it was just very, very strange. You know, whatever this thing is, it's moving very, very fast. It clearly was, you know, making some type of audible sound. But we couldn't pinpoint what it was, and then this sound was way out in front of us, and then we could hear it accelerating directly toward us. And at that point, one of our party, one of the women, got a little unnerved, and she's just like, "Look, I'm heading for the car right now," and you know, I'm starting to get, you know, kind of freaked out. So, you know, so we moved toward the car. I mean, my scientific curiosity was still very intact, and I wanted to stay and try to, you know, see if we could see something, because that hole in the sky was still getting broader. But yeah, I wanted to keep the peace here in the party. So you know, we said our goodbyes with you, but I knew I'd, you know, want to follow up with you and come back again sometime. And you were very gracious in extending that invitation, but. So we go back to Portland. Well, very early the next morning, I get a phone call from my lady friend who'd been taking the pictures out in the field, and she's going, "Oh, my God, Joel, you wouldn't believe what turned up on these pictures." So I invited her to come on over to my house, and I brought my other friends who had joined us, the husband and wife who had the meditation teacher and his wife. I invited them to come over as well. So my friend brings over her pictures that she had just had developed at Safeway, and lays them down on the table in front of me, and it was just amazing. Here in this series of pictures that she had been taking out in the field and then back toward our group, you could see these little, you know, you call them kind of dolphin-shaped orbs. To me, they looked more like, if you could picture what Darth Vader's helmet would look like,
yeah,
but in a kind of pale, you know, kind of translucent cloud type of color, you know, that's the best way I could think of it. It had that kind of bell shape, the way Darth Vader's helmet was shaped. And you know, one picture you could see maybe two, and another one you could see three. You know, you could see some of them were closer toward where the one holding the camera was versus the others. You could make out some depth, and clearly these were multiple, you know, objects out there, some sort. she had this amazing picture where there was this beam of green, like this emerald green light. It was just this beautiful shaft of green light that was right there in the field as well, which was a strange anomaly. But without a doubt, the picture that was just absolutely the most dramatic was this picture of this large, orb, the one that you described when you said, you have this picture of me sitting there. Well, I'm sitting there in that camp chair, my friend Mike's sitting right next to me, and this large bell-shaped orb is like 3 feet over my head. And, it was like, what the heck is that thing? And then I remember we sent those pictures up to you, and it was not till probably a year and a half later that you said you finally had someone else send you something similar. And it was a woman from Sedona, Arizona, who had taken a picture in her backyard that was of that same type of object, that same shape, orb, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But it was very unusual. I mean, we don't know whether that's what was causing the sound, this unusual sound anomaly. But clearly there were these these objects or whatever they were there that were outside the range of human visual perception, but clearly were within the range of the camera shutter speed to be able to capture that.
Mm-hmm.
And I liken that to, if an object is vibrating at a frequency that's outside the range of human visual perception, it doesn't mean that it's not there. It just means that we can't perceive it with the human eye. And I had flown on a lot of these small airplanes, that were prop driven planes. And anyone who's watched one of these, or even a room fan, your normal, box fan in your room that you might blow out the hot air in the summertime, when you have the fan off, you look at it, you can clearly see the blades of the propeller there of the fan. But then when you turn the fan on low speed, it becomes more difficult to see those fins, those blades of the fan, because the vibrational frequency is increasing and it's nearing the frequency where the human eye can no longer pick it up. Then if you turn it on high speed, it's going so fast, the frequency so high, that now it's outside the range of human visual perception, and it appears to be invisible, like they aren't even there. But you know darn well, if you suddenly, put your hand in through the slots of the fan, you're going to get a nasty chunk taken out of your flesh there.
Yeah.
And so it's... That was the closest analogy that I could make to what I'd personally experienced at your ranch that first time, that there's a frequency phenomenon that just means that these things are difficult for us to detect, but certainly with the different types of video technology, which has come so far over the years, you've got your infrared and all these, night vision and all kinds of things that make these orb phenomena so much more apparent and easier to track. It's just phenomenal. But that was that first experience. I apologize for the long background on it, but maybe the listening audience will find it, kind of a compelling story. But that brought me back. That initial experience brought me back to your ranch. What now? It's probably been, I don't know, maybe 30 times that I've been to your place, over these intervening 11 years, and have seen, a lot of dramatic aerial anomalies over that time. In addition to that, of course, there's been so many remarkable people and meetings and relationships that have come from socializing with open-minded people who are are hungry for understanding, who are seeking for, you know, what is true behind the big picture questions that are going on our little planet. And I've found it a continued source of encouragement, of hope, and of, you know, good-natured friendship, many of which have been very enduring, you know, such as the relationship that you and I share personally. And I want to thank you for the gift that you have given to so many over the years in opening your home to thousands of people who were strangers to you at first and allowing them to have their own personal experience of something amazing, because that's not something you find many people be willing to do, James. So my hat's off to you.
Yeah, thanks. Just recently we've had, and you've met some of these people, we've had Boeing engineers, we've had triple PhD Boeing engineers and Skunk Works people, Lockheed engineers. Actually, John Riley was a Lockheed engineer, or still, I don't know if he works for him anymore, but he actually filmed after an intention experiment to initiate contact, one of the ships flying right over the conference building, and he got that on film. But we've had Air Force base commanders, air traffic controllers, pilots, people from every walk of life, you know, that would be in the know, have their own experiences here, and they've all said, we don't know whose ships these are. They're definitely not ours. They're nothing we've back engineered. Their technologies are too vast. And I just had a NASA guy here, and I can't really mention his name because I don't want to get him in trouble, but he's part of a very elite group high up in NASA, and he looked at some of the footage we have of these just massive ships flying over the house, powering up, whiting out the whole screen of the camera, and then going off and making a turn, you know, like the ones filmed with Paranormal State and the Danny Dyer special. You know, ABC's been up here, Fox News, everybody. But anyway, to make a long story short, I said, look, I really want your opinion about this. What are these things? And I said, here's this massive triangle ship. And I said, is this the NOS satellite system flying over? And he told me, he goes, that's a joke. He said, that never really worked. He said, because they couldn't get it to fly flat, because the way space is, when you have something in orbit, it always wants to go up and down. And he just said that thing never worked. And he said that a lot of these are just cover stories, you know, and he gave me the skinny on a lot of it. And he said, what I'm seeing here and what you've shown me, I can verify without a shadow of a doubt. These are not anything that we have up there. This isn't any of our back engineered stuff. And he said, they're definitely some extremely advanced beings. And then so I tried to kind of grill him to find out how much he knew about the different groups that are coming to the Earth, and I was really surprised that they didn't really know. They didn't really know that much. They knew they were there. They knew they were flying around, and they knew maybe a couple groups that are interfacing, but the amount of information they did know, I was shocked.
Well, you know, I think what's very clear just in, you know, being up there at your residence for all these numbers of visits and having a chance to just, you know, sit back and listen and watch, observe and experience, there's something much more than technological that's going on. And it's evident in seeing how people are impacted emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, as well, in many cases, there's an opening that seems to happen in a lot of people based on their experience. That's not what you normally find when someone is simply observing a new technology or development in science. Mm-hmm. You don't find that same wide range of human effects. And because much more than just the intellectual gets stimulated by people who go make these visits to your ranch. And, you know, so to me there's something quite coherent and intelligent that is going on. It's quite evident that in so many of these sightings there is communication. I mean, countless times I've seen where you have either said, okay, everybody, there's going to be something showing up in the sky at such and such time, and that ends up being the case, or where we have people out there, you know, they sight something and they're watching it, and you know, people will be out in the field, you know, verbally saying, hey, light up, show us something, whatever, and then all of a sudden, you know, pow, you see this object all of a sudden start flashing coherently or making some other, you know, type of sign of communication that is so far beyond chance coincidence. And it happens, repeatedly. You know, it just takes this to a whole nother level. So I don't think that any back engineered technology that our military or other human agencies, you know, might have developed over the years, I doubt that they would be doing this type of interaction, with a bunch of regular folks just, you know, sitting out in the field, because why would they be keeping those technologies secret if they were doing this? Well, what would be the purpose?
Yeah, that's never made any sense. I mean, there's a lot of distractors, you know, including Michael Horn out there that says that basically, well, they first said there are no ships here whatsoever. And then he changed his tune to, oh, they're military ships. And then back to there are no ships whatsoever. And I've heard it all. And I go, come on, just get your story straight. But the problem is, you know, we're seeing like purple, green, pink, orange, right, every color you can think of,
right,
and every size and shape possible. And yeah, and to me, to think that our Black Project guys have nothing else to do but to come over to the East City Ranch and put on a show every night,
right,
is an extreme waste of time. I mean, if I had technology like that, I'd be out in space checking other stuff out.
Exactly.
Or I would be creating, you know, a base somewhere on Mars or the Moon, or which they have actually, and you know, I would have been doing a lot more important things than taking my whole armada over the ranch, you know, 3 or 4 times a week to put a show on it. It makes no sense whatsoever. I wish
no,
these guys.
I agree with you. It's a real disconnect in logic, and you know, and I think it's not. It's not congruent with the emotional reactions that people are having with their experience, because so many of these appear to be a highly personal communication that's going on, because people, you know, I know you must have seen dozens and dozens of these, but in my own experience, just, you know, watching and listening and talking to people up there over the years, you know, some have just been very profoundly impacted by what they experienced. And, I mean, it literally, like, changed how they approached their life. And you could hear it with them. You could see the sincerity that they were speaking with, that something had shifted. And they knew that there was something much bigger going on that involves all of us. And I guess what I've taken away from that is something very comforting, that, you know, we're all in this together. You know, we're still peeling back these, you know, layers of the onion. But I think that there's... overall, I think there's a very benign, loving hand that's orchestrating the whole show here, and we're part of that. You know, we have interplay with that, and then, you know, there's some ignorant elements that maybe have forgotten how we're supposed to to, you know, interact with each other, that, you know, maybe using some, you know, less than graceful tactics in going about their business. And, of course, I'm talking about the ones who are still, you know, hung up on the, you know, oppression, suppression, surveillance, you know, war is profitable, you name it, you know, that it's all about some type of self, you know, concept of self where separation from everyone else makes sense rather than the concept that, you know, we all are connected, that our source is the same. We all spring from that same source of life and energy and mind. And that, you know, we have a common destiny. So doesn't it make sense to cooperate and make this a beautiful experience for all of us? Because we have that capacity to do that. I believe as a scientist, but also as a man of spiritual depth and mm-hmm. some limited insight from my own experience, you know, that we have the capacity to restore the earth to a garden and a home planet that works for everybody and that is beautiful and abundant, that is clean, it's healthy, and it's happy. I really feel that. And I feel that, you know, my own intense pull toward the field of breakthrough energy technologies and their implications and the promise of what a healing modality free energy could be for our planet, it is so much of what gives me hope for us going forward in a healthy and whole way, because I think it is going to happen that way. I am optimistic that, you know, despite the bumpiness of things that we've endured and probably quite a few things that are yet to come as we see these various events, unsettling events, you know, accelerating. You mm-hmm. know, it can be like, geez, are we going to make it to the other side of something here? And well, I believe, yes, we will. And the energy technologies are going to come into play in this in a very big way. And we're starting to see, you know, the curtain to the wizard's dark room be pulled back a bit, you know, and it's a fascinating time. So there's a clear connection, and you've spoken of it for a long time. You know, there's a clear connection between what's going on in these the contact between Earth and non-Earth cultures, the technologies that might be involved in such, and the relationship between the advanced propulsion and energy technologies that must be, you know, part of what's in the equation for someone to travel interstellar distances. So I find this to be a remarkable time to be on planet Earth.
Yeah, what are some of the recent breakthroughs? I guess first define what breakthrough energy technology would be. And then maybe after that, we can go through what are some of the most recent breakthroughs that are happening, you know, in the new energy technologies.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we call our book, Gene Manning, my co-author and I, we call our book Breakthrough Power. And what is a breakthrough energy technology mean to us? Well, I'll start with a negative statement. The conventional renewable technologies of wind, solar, geothermal, biofuels, important as a lot of those are to be in our renewable energy portfolio, we consider none of those to be breakthrough energy technologies. In fact, in most cases, these have been around for centuries. I mean, you think about windmills, okay? You think about about solar energy, you know, these things, or you know, biofuels. Guess what? Wood is a biofuel, okay? So humans have been taking advantage of these renewable technologies, or the conventional renewables, for a long, long time. And you know, there has been solid yet incremental progress on being able to make improvements in how we can utilize those maybe more cost-effectively or with smaller footprint or with maybe less emissions or things like that. But yet those technologies, those conventional renewables, still have many limitations to them that, you know, a lot of people aren't aware of until they stop and think about it. And I want to expound a little bit on that before actually defining what is a real breakthrough energy technology. If you look at the conventional renewables, let's just look at wind and solar. You know, by the very nature of the source of the energy, whether it's wind or direct sunlight, those are very intermittent by nature, because we don't have, you know, the sun shining, you know, around the clock. The wind does not blow, you know, at a constant or a even sufficient speed where you end up erecting a windmill. And so you don't have the continuous source of power that would be ideal for a power source. If you're looking at using a biofuel, whether it's wood or it's biodiesel or ethanol or whatever, when you look at these, well, you know, these are dependent on, let's say in the case of ethanol, they're dependent on crop planting, crop harvesting, seasonality, okay, very intermittent, you know, not anything at all that's continuous. And we look at what some of the inputs are on these. If you're looking at, again, looking at biofuels, for instance, you know, you might in many cases be using a fossil fuel-based fertilizer to grow the corn to produce the ethanol. You're using, you know, diesel-powered tractors to cultivate. You're using diesel-powered trucks to transport from the refinery, the biorefinery, to the market, whatever. I mean, so there's a heavy fossil fuel footprint there. If you're looking in you know, these windmills, these giant windmills now, you know, for your listeners who are familiar with the Columbia Gorge, which definitely is one of the jewels of the American landscape from my perspective, it's spectacularly beautiful. But yet over the last several years, you know, parts of the Columbia Gorge now are, you know, more than dotted with these giant wind turbines. You know, they go on for miles. And quite frankly, to me, it's not a beautiful aspect of the landscape to see, you know, all these giant wind turbines up there. There's not a lot of aesthetic appeal in that, which is, you know, one of the shortcomings of that technology, not to mention the intermittent aspect of wind. And then there's also, you know, a lot of these giant wind turbines, you know, they take a heavy toll on a lot of the bird populations, the bat populations, the whole colonies of the raptors, the eagles and hawks that have been you know, terrifically depleted because, you know, the birds have a hard time seeing these blades. I mean, the tip speed of these giant wind turbines is very, very fast. I mean, the velocity of that tip speed, it's It's very fast, much faster than a bird can avert. So a lot of these things, they don't even see them. They get smacked out of the sky. And there's harmonics that are produced by those wind turbines. I mean, they set up a frequency. They have their own frequency. And those harmonics can be very disruptive, to human sleep cycles, to other, fauna in the area as well. So, it's not all rosy in the conventional renewable sector. You know, we've seen here with what's been in the news a lot these last, month or so has been this debacle with the solar panel manufacturer Solyndra, where the U.S. Department of Energy in 2009, they provided $585 million, taxpayer dollars, in loan guarantees for this California solar company. And then, of course, just a couple months ago, this company went bankrupt and they shuttered their doors. And the taxpayer was hung with $500 million that was, provided to this solar company by our U.S. Department of Energy. That is such a heavy level of subsidization of that renewable technology. I mean, solar,
wasn't that Pelosi's husband too?
Excuse me?
I think it was Pelosi's husband.
Could be. I haven't looked that deep. But
yeah, look at who got the contract. You'd be surprised. But there was a major scandal on that one, and that might be the one you're talking about.
Could be. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that these technologies would not even be be part of the portfolio if it weren't for the fact that the taxpayer has been heavily subsidizing these. Because solar panel costs have come down quite steeply over the last few years from where they were, it's still the technology is expensive relative to to the conventional grid technologies that are coming from the polluting fuels, whether it's coal or natural gas or hydropower, not being so much a polluting fuel or polluting technology, but it definitely has environmental impacts from the standpoint of the dams and that. But we look at how much public treasure is involved in supporting these energy technologies, especially these conventional renewables. It's quite a bit. In Europe, they've had even much, much higher subsidies there. Now those subsidies in Europe are starting to dry up because of the economic fallouts that are happening around the globe, and including in the European theater now. So that's rippling all through these solar manufacturers, because the market in Europe is not nearly as robust for panels. You got very inexpensive panels coming out of China now. That's suddenly causing a lot of these big U.S. startups to fall by the board. I just saw where First Solar, which was the largest U.S. solar manufacturer, they've been just announced large layoffs. Their stock price has plummeted. They're having a hard time here, and there's going to be a number of these solar companies that fall out, because they've been dependent on subsidies, whether abroad or here domestically. They've made projections that, that the competition was going to be such and such. But now we see the Chinese dumping a lot of very inexpensive panels in the U.S. market. So this whole thing is kind of a real bag of worms right now. So I kind of want to jump off from some of the warts of the conventional renewable technologies to what we actually mean by a breakthrough. And by a breakthrough energy technology, we're talking about something that is on the frontier of our scientific understanding that has the capability to be a very potent, high-density power source that could be used off-grid, could be something that each homeowner or each business could have generating its own power cleanly and relatively cheaply, to the point where from a practical standpoint, it could eventually be considered, you know, free energy, and could provide the impetus for us to have a transformation in the way we go about our business of this planet here. So I want to give a couple examples of that. Here very recently, you know, there, and I would say it, certainly in this last year, there's been a lot of exposure to the cold fusion field because of the work that has been done by this particular Italian inventor named Andrea Rossi. Mm-hmm. And Andrea Rossi has a technology that he calls the ECAT, or energy catalyzer process, which is essentially a variant of the cold fusion field. Now most people who are old enough to remember the original rollout of the idea of cold fusion, which was back in 1989, they may remember that, okay, there were a couple of scientists from Utah named Fleshman and Pons. They made this dramatic announcement. They were on the cover of Time magazine. They were on all the evening news. This was going to be, you know, the world-saving technology. And but very promptly, the lords of science from MIT and other prestigious universities came out and slammed the door by saying that this was junk science. And those two Utah scientists were essentially drummed out of the academic circles as essentially heretics. Mm-hmm. And that really slammed the door on cold fusion. So researchers who were involved in that field, when they came, you know, when they came up with some very unique variants and developments in the cold fusion field, when they would apply for patent, the U.S. Patent Office would not review these. They would not issue patent on anything related to cold fusion, and that was, you know, that was definitely something that we would consider a suppression action. It was not based on good science, because the MIT announcements were political in nature. They were not based on sound evidence or sound analysis of the original cold fusion experiments. And fortunately, a lot of open-minded researchers around the world continued to pursue the cold fusion field. And continued to see that there was something to this, and you know, when you look at why the as I call them, the lords of science just totally trampled on the idea of cold fusion, it's generally because the vested interests in their own research in something called hot fusion, which is basically scientific research trying to mimic the way a star produces energy, you know, fusing together, you know, light elements like hydrogen to form helium under very, very high pressure and temperature conditions, and hopefully trying to get, you know, some reaction, some of these nuclear fusion reactions that yield an excess of energy. That's the vested interest that so many of these nuclear physicists have had that poo-pooed, mm-hmm. you know, the cold fusion field. So, you know, the taxpayer, the U.S. taxpayer, has funded tens of billions of dollars in research for hot fusion over the last 30 years. And every time there's, you know, a profile done, and you'll see them on the Science Channel, sometimes you see it on the History Channel or on Discovery or whatever, where they talk about, you know, the hot fusion, and there's variants of that. it's always 10 years away. It's always 10 years away. And it's been like that for the last 30 years. It's just another 10 years away. You know, but how many tens of billions of dollars are we going to keep slogging toward that field? Well, you know, lo and behold, Andrea Rossi this past year announces that that he has a very replicable process that uses very inexpensive reactants in his process, those reactants being powdered nickel and a little bit of hydrogen gas and a very inexpensive proprietary catalyst. And when he combines those, that powdered nickel, the hydrogen gas, and this catalyst in a very small little reaction chamber that's maybe the size of a pop can, and that mixture is heated up to about 400 degrees, suddenly it initiates a fusion reaction, a nuclear fusion reaction, where some of those hydrogen atoms fuse with the nickel. There's actually a transmutation that occurs. There's some copper produced. A new element is formed, which is a nuclear transmutation. And in a nuclear fusion reaction, there's an enormous amount of excess energy released, and in this case, in the form of heat. And so that the amount of heat that's required to raise the temperature of those reactants in the Rossi ECAT device, you look at the amount of heat that's required to bring that temperature up to the 400 degrees, well, the amount of excess heat that's released from the reaction is at least 30 times that amount, or what we might say is 30 times over unity. So it's a vast excess amount of energy. And, Rossi, not only did he say he had such a device, but it was tested in front of a group of scientists at the University of Bologna, in Italy, which is the Europe's oldest university, very prestigious. He then said that he was going to demonstrate a 1 megawatt cold fusion reactor array in October of 2011. And he made that pronouncement, over 6 months ago. And one thing that, in following a lot of these new energy developments and announcements over the years, one thing we almost never find is that an inventor keeps to the timetable that he lays out. Mm-hmm. But Rossi, to his credit, actually held a demonstration in Bologna, Italy, on October 28, just, a month and a half ago, and had 30 witnesses that were there, including the client who was there to the client who would purchase this device or this array of devices if the demonstration was successful to their satisfaction. And there were also many other witnesses there, including someone from the New Energy Movement, one who's on our board of directors, who was over there. His name's Sterling Allen, who produces a new free energy newsletter on his website. Mm-hmm. And then several other media personalities were there from, various large media outlets, both in Europe and in the United States, I think Associated Press, I believe, had one of their correspondents there as well. So anyway, this demonstration goes. And again, the goal was to demonstrate a working, robust, 1 megawatt cold fusion technology. And I think they ended up, it worked pretty much to the way it was designed. I think they had a few, a few glitches. Overall, I think they generated 500 kilowatts rather than 1 megawatt. So about half of what they hoped to demonstrate, they were able to demonstrate. But the point of it being is that they demonstrated a very robust, over Unity technology. Well, apparently that customer who they were demonstrating for, and I'm just kind of parroting what I have heard through my circles based on comments that the inventor, Andrea Rossi, had made, that client was a U.S. military client, and that they have since contracted for, to this time, approximately 13 of these devices from mm-hmm. Rossi. So the implication there is that our own U.S. military, which, by the way, buys stuff using taxpayer dollars, you know, apparently has an intense interest to be a client for cold fusion technology. All right? Mm-hmm. Now, you'd think that that'd be all over the front page of everything. now to their credit, some of the mainstream media outlets did report on this to a small degree. They haven't picked up the story in any, you know, robust continuing way like, you know, a lot of the alternative media have. But it's definitely getting, it's rippling its way into the awareness of the, you know, the political machinery. In fact, last week, Mitt Romney mentioned cold fusion in one of his interviews, I guess, you know, as part of his, you know, Republican primary campaign and all that. So it's definitely, you know, something that's going to get a lot more, you know, a lot more visibility. It's going to be on the airwaves more and more. And so we think we're seeing, you know, one of the doors of breakthrough energy finally opening up, you know, when a foot's getting wedged in that door, so this information can start getting out. So that's been a remarkable development this past year and even in this past month and a half. And there's a lot of internet activity out there watching this very closely. Anyone who Googles Rossi cold fusion, you know, you're going to find now, you know, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of articles now. And so there's a very dedicated, you know, cadre of researchers and reporters who are now following that field very closely. So that's probably the single most exciting development that's happened in this field here of late.
Have you looked into, I know there was a kid in Tigard, I don't know if you looked into that, but supposedly he created this nano solar technology where he said that he increased the output 500% with this new technology, and it hit the Oregonian, and there was a major story about it. And the next thing you see is that some corporation, I think, gave him a $10,000 scholarship or something like that. It's at one, you know, who knows, one some major university, and then it just disappeared off the air. I mean, and you can't even find out anything about it. We tracked the kid down, and we tried to get him to come on the air and do an interview about, you know, what he came up with, but I guess they said no way.
Yeah, I remember when that story broke, and was hoping to get some follow up because I'd sent in an inquiry as well. To try to meet with the students directly, but there was nothing that ended up coming out of that. So, you know, don't really know where that has gone. You know, it wouldn't be the first time though where an energy breakthrough suddenly got pulled behind closed doors.
Oh yeah.
So, it's unfortunate that has been. Such a common part of the history of these developments, but it has been one of the strong barriers to having these things make it out into the public domain.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to see you know, a lot more of these things, you know, make it out into the public's awareness. I mean, the reason why we set up New Energy Movement, which is a nonprofit educational organization, is to educate the mainstream public and our policymakers and the investment community, you know, on the fact that there's a lot of remarkable technologies of merit that deserve our support, you know, that deserve to be researched thoroughly, to be funded, to become, you know, another tool in our arsenal to help get us off of our dependence on polluting fuels, you know, which include, you know, the hydrocarbon fuels, you know, coal and oil and gas and nuclear power as well. Give us options to be able to remove dams from our riverways as well. You know, so we should be really, really focused on looking at these frontiers of science, looking into every one of these technologies that show some real technological merit, because, you know, we just talked about how the U.S. Department of Energy threw $500 million of our taxpayer money toward this failed solar company. I mean, a tiny fraction of that would raise the boats of so many of these small, independent, maverick inventors and researchers. I mean, you can't believe, you know, when you meet so many of these, as I have, and I know you've met some of them too, James. I mean, most of them are operating on fumes of you know, financing. You know, they've poured their hearts and their you know, and their time and, you know, their own personal resources into these, and a lot of them live in very modest circumstances, and they've had tremendous challenges in getting the type of even modest funding to allow them to move forward on these things. And mm-hmm. it's something we continually advocate for. You know, we look at the fact that the funding mechanism has not been, it's been heavily biased from the investment community toward, I guess what we would say is the conventional renewables, you know, yeah. wind, solar, and biofuels, despite the fact that there are so many vulnerabilities to those technologies. As we said, the intermittency, the fact that they're so heavily dependent on subsidies, that they have other environmental issues as well. They take up a lot of land area, you know, a lot of things like that. You know, whereas these other technologies that may be flying, you know, somewhat in the face of scientific understanding, but mm-hmm. are demonstrating real measurable effects. I mean, you know, my degree is in applied science. I'm not a theoretical scientist. I'm interested if something works. You know, if it works, let's use it. Let's figure out the theory later. You know, I'm not bashful about, you know, saying, look, I don't care that someone's, you know, another scientist who's trying to protect their own gravy train of research funding that's coming in the way of government or corporate grants, you know, I don't really care about that. I mean, we got a bigger picture here on our planet, problems that we got to deal with here, and we can't, you know, or I would ask that you know, scientists who are really, you know, too afraid of losing their funding in the face of a technology that might leapfrog them, you know, mm-hmm. my appeal is, geez, consider your children. Consider your grandchildren. Okay? Let's get in this and all get in the boat that's rowing in the same direction. You know, let's don't be so daggone concerned, you know, about getting our little slice, you know, when we could all be doing something in a grand way that lifts up all of us. You know, mm-hmm. we got to move more in that direction. Now, I understand, you know, what it means to earn a livelihood and to be able to provide for your family and all these things. But when scientists themselves become very unscientific because of their own vested interest in their own research, rather than being willing to open-mindedly look at new data like a scientist is supposed to do. When they don't do that, when they close their eyes or they call something else a fraud without even investigating it because it potentially disrupts their own vested interest in their own research, then to me you have lost the title scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're just operating
businessman.
Well, from greed, basically.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing. I have limited, you know, I'm just not interested in engaging those people, you know.
So yeah.
You know, we got to be able to move forward collaboratively. It's very clear that our policymakers, our legislators, the government, the leadership is so weak. There's a tremendous degree of corruption that's in our elected offices. You know, we've seen this through the whole financial boondoggles over these last few years. Same thing with this whole energy picture. You know, the money's changing hands so fast and furiously, you know, at the political level. And it's you know, the big corporations that are, you know, wagging that dog. And, you know, these little maverick inventors aren't seeing hardly anything here that could really bring these breakthroughs about. And that's why New Energy Movement as an organization, we're going right for the mainstream public to enliven their awareness and their passion and their interest so that people realize that we're all stakeholders in this. And and so what we would love is for you know, the mainstream average citizen to want to be able to provide some material support of some sort for the new energy scene. And we would very much love to have some philanthropic capital come forward from you know, people of wealth who recognize that having some of these breakthroughs get into the public domain very soon is absolutely critical in addressing some of these very difficult problems that we have on the planet. You know, rather than taking the approach of a venture capitalist where it's all about profit, you know, a philanthropic benefactor can bring capital in that's based on what's this going to do for the planet. That's the payoff. And and the risk is not about the risk of your money. It's the risk of not doing this.
I agree. You know, the tough part is finding somebody, you know, a lot of these people that do have the money and have the big money, basically they're heavily invested, you know, probably in the oil industry or something else, or they're afraid of losing their empire by going up against, you know, the big companies. And so that's the tough nut to crack. You know, it's almost like if you had somebody like that, they would have to like give it incognito or with no attachment to it or demands behind it or anything like that. And that's probably the only way it would happen through that avenue.
I think you're right on the mark. I think you are right on the mark that, you know, whatever your social circle is, there's tremendous fear of being ostracized from that circle, you know, and we all have our circles, you know, we all do, you know, and so we have that peer pressure that says, hey, you know, keep the status quo, you know, don't disrupt this because, you know, you're going to lose relationships if you do this. And maybe in some cases it's more serious than just losing relationships. Maybe there's some actual heavy-handed, whispering. More of a hammer that's applied that says thou shalt not do this if you want to maintain your standing, you know, amongst this. I imagine there's been quite a few, we see some of these billionaires who have been philanthropists in certain areas. You know, you look at the Gates Foundation and some of these others, you know, these billionaires who are pledging to give away their billions. Well, why the heck isn't any of that seeming to come to this field? You know, it goes into a lot of these other fields, maybe medicine or some other stuff. You know, but is somebody getting a talking to? You know, like, you shall not raise the boats of these maverick inventors or else. You know, I don't know. But there's a lot of awfully smart people, you know, that have accrued these billions of dollars. And I've got to think that with all the advisors they have, they got to be, you know, kind of keeping their finger or their eye on the pulse of what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's something's going on. There's something intentional going on that is not, you know, raising the visibility of these breakthrough energy technologies and what's going on, you know, behind this.
And, well, I've seen the heavy handedness firsthand, and I've seen, you know, scientists have their families threatened, their labs blown up. I've even seen a couple of them die. I think, is it Eugene or Gene Maloff? I'm trying to.
Well, Eugene Maloff. Yeah. He was murdered.
Yeah.
Quite a few. May have,
yeah. Quite a few lost their lives in this Stanley, you know, look at, with his water machine, you know, he had a meeting with the military and then ended up dead the next day. So, yeah, there's definitely some major heavy-handedness going on in this movement. So that's what I was saying. It might be, if you do have somebody with a heart that knows that this has to get out to turn this planet around, you know, maybe they can do it anonymously or something, and then provide some protection somehow for the people that are getting ready to bring these new technologies out.
Right. Well, you hit on a good point here, the protection. Now, this is something that, you know, I've given a lot of thought to and in, you know, in collaboration with a number of other colleagues who are part of this scene in the new energy movement is, you know, what is the best way to provide security for an inventor of a breakthrough energy technology?
Mm-hmm.
And when you go through the various scenarios, it always comes down to the same thing. It's getting the information disseminated as fast as possible to as many people around this planet who can have plans in hand to replicate the technology. And that is open sourcing. From my standpoint, mm-hmm. The biggest reason why we have not seen to this point in time any of these very promising technologies be available at Walmart or Costco or wherever you might want to do your shopping for your appliances is because the open sourcing concept has not been embraced by the inventor community. If it had been, we would have seen these things out in the hands of the replicators. And I'll tell you, there is a very vibrant and robust group of, you know, call them, you know, garage enthusiasts, you know, workbench hobbyists, whatever, people skilled in electronics and mechanics, things like this, who would love to have the how-to-build plans for a working over-unity device. I know that because I meet with these people. In fact, I've been encouraging the formation of replicator groups across the country. Here in Portland, we now have such a group established, and just established one back in the state of Maryland a few months ago. And there's one in the Vancouver, British Columbia, and in the San Francisco Bay Area as well. And I'm sure there's others who I'm not familiar with. But anyway, I think it's a very important effort to have these replicator groups, you know, growing and vibrant and hungry to make connections with inventors who are willing to open source the technology. But I think once we have, you know, technologies that are robust, that can be replicated, especially ones who can be replicated with stock parts rather than custom fabricated parts, you know, we would see a very quick rise in deployment of these technologies across the planet. And once you see that, you'll see a mad dash to be second a lot of other inventors who've kept things close to their vest, or they've been trying to play the kind of business as usual game of going through, you know, the patenting process and venture capital and all of this. Because I would propose that an inventor who is willing to recognize that the idea was given to them freely by whatever that agency of mind is, that is universal. All right, we've all been inspired with something in our lives. But for these who've been given a technological gift of insight, that was a free gift. And when an inventor can recognize that that gift was freely given, and that when they give it freely again to the world, that there's going to be tremendous abundance and support brought to those inventors that bring themselves in harmony with the idea of sharing. And I think that it has been the lack of awareness or lack of willingness to employ that universal principle. You know, sharing brings abundance because it's aligned with the one thing that can be, that every time you give it away, there's more, which is love, of course.
I've noticed that we both run into that same problem where we know inventors that have some pretty amazing technologies, and I do understand their point of view. You know, they've invested, you know, thousands and thousands, sometimes millions of dollars of their own money, and maybe 20 or 30 years of their life into this baby, you know, and they're just not ready to just let it go.
Right.
And they can't get it out. They can't get a patent on it or anything else because the powers that be will come steal it in the interest of national security. Yep. So it's like a catch-22. They're stuck. Nothing's happening. Nobody's benefiting from it. They're not benefiting. The people aren't benefiting. I don't know what to break out of that, because what you're talking about is a total shift in consciousness. But these other people have so much invested in this, they're just not ready to let go of that.
Well, you're right. And the thing that I could offer them is this. Look, you read the Breakthrough Power book, you will see it's full of stories of inventors who went to their graves with something that could have been world-changing if they had given it away. All right. And don't be another one of these. There's been enough. We don't have to keep repeating that pattern. You know, there's all kinds of ways that an inventor who open sources his technology will be materially supported. You know, to make such a magnanimous gesture, there are people, I know so many people who would go like, hell, I mean, I'd send him some money to do that. He becomes a hero for the planet. You know, he offers a technology that essentially allows you to have free energy. I mean, look how many thousands of dollars each of us spend in energy, whether it's the gasoline for our car or natural gas or electrical power to heat our homes, to power our lights, you know, blah, 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 on and on and on. I mean, who among us wouldn't go, geez, you know, you're going to be the, you know, the Wright brother of free energy here, you know, I'd give you some money. You know what I mean? Even though you're not asking for it, I would do that in material support of you going ahead and just laying it on the line for everybody. I think people are very fair-minded for the most part and would give something back. And you know what? From a pure business standpoint, an inventor who does this, they will have started the engines of commerce in so many startup companies that get launched around such a technology. There'd be so many derivatives and spin-offs of technology that came off of a robust free energy technology that who would be the number one consultant they'd want to bring on board? It would be that inventor, all right? And who would be the one they'd want to have on their board of directors? It'd be that inventor. You know, these are compensated positions. Consultants you know, consultants can make an awful lot of money. You know, they could make the talk show circuits. They could be, you know, writing books. I mean, you know, if people can make millions of dollars having a show called Jersey Shore or whatever, I mean, I would think that, you know, an inventor of a free energy technology that becomes ubiquitous around the planet is likely going to have some value in making a few TV appearances as well. So I see that there's all kinds of ways of material support, you know, manifesting for an inventor who has the insight, the courage, and the heart to do what is in the best interest of our species and our planet.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was thinking if they just filmed the machines running, showing the output on these machines, and then said, okay, here's the plans for these machines. Here's how to build them. You know, a little YouTube video with a PayPal button, you know, on a website or something. They would definitely be compensated, you know, just even by just selling the plans or to me, I think through implication of this, you know, apply this, basically get it. Implementation, that's what I was looking for, or applying this, start building these things, you know, build a whole bunch of them and just shotgun them out there.
Right.
And they go from there.
And see, that's the role of the replicator groups. You see, because generally a lone inventor, even with a small team, they're still relatively vulnerable. They're small. It's really hard. Distribution is not as easy as it sounds like. I'll give you a practical example of some of the challenges here. You know, I've invented a water purification technology. This is something that came about 6 years ago. You know, and I had a company that has spent millions of dollars into the development of that technology. Through various aspects of researching the materials required, of the engineering required to turn a laboratory prototype into a commercial prototype, going through the regulatory hurdles to get them approved for sale in each state or region, you know, marketing materials, you know, paying for you to go see people here and there, blah, 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 blah. You know, and finally, 6 years and several million dollars later, these things now are ready to sell. Okay, now that is not a process that is easily born by one individual or a small team that's not well resourced. So, from the standpoint of an open source project, I think it very much requires to have a group of replicators that you can plug into, especially some who you know well and who are trustable. And it's part of why, you know, New Energy Movement, I know myself personally, you know, I go out and I try to meet people who are interested in doing this, who are essentially setting, you know, making their own little network and circle where others who are interested in doing the replication. They've kind of got their small group of enthusiasts ready to go, and basically they're just chomping at the bit of gosh, send us an open source project, you know, and we'll get after it. I think that they are a very key part of this because you want to have some redundancy in the ability to make these things. You definitely don't want it all concentrated in one head, and it doesn't take, you know, an assassin's bullet to send a great new technology to the grave. I mean, it can take, you know, that can happen by anything. I mean, you can walk out into the street, you know, and you know, get hit, you know, by a bus. It doesn't have to take a heavy-handed act of suppression. I mean, people leave this planet all the time for natural reasons here. It's important to get the redundancy into this, having a good group of replicators, you know, having the open sourcing. The internet is such an incredible, powerful tool to disseminate information, you know, and it should be sent around the world, you know. You look at how these social action initiatives that have happened throughout the Middle East by the way of the internet, by the way of, you know, social media, you know, by, you know, cell phones, things like that, where people are mobilized very quickly and where status quo control measures simply become obsolete. You can't, you know, the power minority cannot control the actions of millions of people who are operating with a citizen's enthusiasm and passion and acting as a headless yet coordinated mass. You know, you can't control that. It's part of the beauty and the evolution of what's going on to see these citizen awakenings where they have, you know, endured a lot of suppression or oppression, whether political or otherwise, you know. And I think a lot of the financial overlords, you know, in the central banking systems and that, I think these movements and the you know, whether it's the Occupy movement or, you know, so many of these bloggers everywhere or, you know, the rise of social media, I think that they're just like, they know that it's coming, you know. They know that it's coming. You look at, you know, Ron Paul, you see all the people who are rallying around him, you know, get rid of the Fed, you know, audit them, then toss them out, you know, whatever. Let's expose what's been going on. I mean, things like that. I mean, there's people of so many millions of citizens of high integrity, very principled people all over the world. They're tired of this nonsense, you know. Mm-hmm. They're willing to do some of the work. They're willing to use some of their sweat, use some of their cash, whatever, to move this forward and get us toward where we can start to heal so many of these, you know, gross injustices and just distorted ways of living that somehow we've come to accept as normal. You know, thankfully, a lot of people are waking up to the fact that it's abnormal and cancerous, and it's time to take action.
Yeah, so this is it Stanley Meyer? I'm trying to remember his name. I think it's Stanley Meyer that created the engines that ran on just pure water.
Right. He had the water fuel cells, what he called it.
Yeah.
Got 91 miles per gallon using water.
Yeah. And I noticed that all of a sudden they're in garages and little workshops all around the country. People are trying to duplicate that, and they are getting some success in raising the mileage, you know, by adding it to fuel or adding the hydrogen to the fuel and things like that. I haven't found somebody that actually has a model that actually works where they can run it 100%. There are claims, and there is a man, I guess it drives this big old Dodge truck around with everything on it, you know, like fully on just water. You know,
his name's Freddy, and he's using. Yeah, there's a lot of inventors who have been doing different processes that are electrolyzing water to make what's called Brown's gas or hydroxy. And then they're feeding that in either to supplement normal gasoline or diesel fuel, or if they've got something really cool where they're using, you know, that that Brown's gas exclusively to power their vehicle. And that would be the reference you made for the guy who's got the, you know, driving around the truck. So we want to see more of that, you know. And, you know, I think that there's definitely people all around the world who've been working on these type of technologies. I know of at least two cases in the Philippines where that's the case as well. Just to give an example that, hey, you know, here's a Southeast Asian country where you've got this type of technology going on, and it's happening all over the place. So we just need to mm-hmm. have, you know, some of these things start popping up, with more regularity, having them spread this around in an open source fashion. And, you'll suddenly see a lot of resistance come overtly from the government on those technologies, because they'll say, whoa, wait a second, where are our fuel taxes going to come from? How are mm-hmm. we going to repair our roads if we can't tax you on your gasoline or your diesel fuel? You're just filling up your gas tank with water? Well, we don't like that. You know, where's the money coming into the government coffers, going through that way? So, as long as we do have roads and we're driving vehicles on roads, there still is there are measures that are required to finance, road maintenance and all that. So, that'll need to be figured out, in a parallel fashion with the technologies. And that could, I don't want to digress too much, but that could come by a mileage fee or something like that. The more you use a resource, the more, I think it's fair, the more you pay for the use of that resource if you're, damaging it, whether it's a road or a forest or whatever, But anyway, you can see some collision coming between, the U.S. Department of Transportation and, other government agencies and that, when these, mm-hmm. technologies that use water as a fuel start to become, much more common.
So. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. Do you need to take a break, or can we make it up to the end of the hour? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm pretty good.
Okay, great. Yeah, so
do
I'd like to just keep going.
To you, James?
What's that?
I said, do I sound a little strident to you? I know I get kind of worked up on some of these issues.
I just wanted to make sure you didn't need to go to the bathroom. I mean, a two-hour show is a long stretch, But
no, I'm still in good shape. Thanks.
Okay. And also, too, I wanted to give the call-in numbers if anybody wants to call in and ask questions about this. There's a toll-free number. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-8008, and that's in U.S. and Canada. Or you can call 530-327-7602, that's line 1, or 530-413-4510, that's line 2, or 530-413-5011, that's line 3. So, and those are up on the BBS site, too, under Station 1, if you want to check that out. So, basically, if you wanted to call in and ask a question, about some of these technologies. Now, both Joel and I know certain individuals. I'm not going to mention any names that have, not just fuelless energy technology that produce abundant amount of energy. They've got, anti-gravity and counter-gravity. So I look way, I'm so far outside the box, I have to get grounded,
sure.
I think about, we're talking about, okay, so we need to take care of the roads, but, so the first thing you do is you implement fuelless energy, and they say, well, we need to take care of the roads. Okay, well, let's implement the counter gravity. And so now you don't need the roads. You don't even need tires or anything else. And then let's implement, counter gravity, and now you're going several thousand miles an hour, almost instantaneously. So, I mean, those are the possibilities, and the technologies here on the planet right now. Are we going to see these technologies? To be honest with you, not until the current regime goes through a total rehaul or overhaul, you might say. I think that's the only way it's going to come about, or if somebody big enough and strong enough with a big enough club is going to step up and say, hey, I'm done with this. Let's get this technology out.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think that, there's a lot of practical issues to be collectively overcome with mm-hmm. Having a lot of people with their own flying machine, essentially. That's I think the last thing a lot of people want is to, you know, feel like they're safe and secure in their bed at night, and all of a sudden someone's flying car comes crashing through the living room. I mean, one thing living on the, living on a curve on a curvy road. Occasionally the drunk, you know, plows into in a tree in your front yard, but it's another thing when people's vehicles are coming out.
But they worked this out. They actually worked this out, and they said that what there would be a network. And it would be computer-driven. It'd have to be pretty solid. But so each car would not, you know, would brake automatically, would not run into the car in front of it. And then you'd have the in-house computer doing the same thing. So you'd have a double failure system. And, you know, you could probably put a triple failure or whatever in there, like a different program. If one shuts down, another one pops on. But they said the technology is there to totally set it up so cars wouldn't be crashing, and you know, automatic braking, automatic distancing, automatic slowing down coming into certain areas. You know, it would all be, you could set it up to where it was all regulated, computer regulated.
I agree that the technology is likely there to do many of those facets. What I see is the part of the evolution, though, is the social acceptance of the concept. Because technology is always just one aspect of things. Mm-hmm. The other part, I mean, kind of the way I look at this, you know, and as a scientist, is the, you know, the technology is probably maybe 20% of the equation. A lot of it comes down to, questions of social acceptability of the long-term impacts of things like wisdom of deployment. For instance, you know, we had, what should we have done with nuclear power? You know, we had this awesome demonstration, and by awesome, I mean, I don't mean like awe-inspiring or wonderful. What I mean by awesome was like, holy cow, you know, what have we done? When we exploded nuclear devices and we saw the devastation that technology could cause to human populations. So what should we have done with that, you know, when we saw that? You know, the cat was out of the bag. Clearly it becomes a powerful military deterrent, hopefully never, you know, to be used again in any offensive fashion. But should we have taken that technology and turned it into a civilian power-generating technology? The nuclear physicists at the time of the Manhattan Project, I'm sure we're going like, oh, my gosh, it's going to be a brand-new industry. You know, gosh, so many promising things, great careers, you know, and all this and that. But who could have foreseen a Fukushima? Who could have foreseen that? Who could have foreseen the fact that if we have a large-scale grid failure, whether from a solar event like a coronal mass ejection that wipes out communication satellites and fries transformers all over the grid, or it's from an intentionally directed electromagnetic pulse, but if the grid goes down in any big way, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of nuclear facilities, nuclear power plants around the globe, including hundreds here in the United States, that become just a few weeks away from meltdown. And that is something that, I read an article about this maybe, I don't know, 2 months ago. And it was chilling when you look at a lot of the technical detail around the preparedness of nuclear facilities to have a grid shutdown, because virtually none of the power plants, the nuclear power plants in the United States, actually use the electricity generated by that plant to power their backup emergency cooling systems. It's seem so counterintuitive, but that is the case. They're reliant on diesel generators for backup power, which are reliant on trucks being able to get there in time. They only got like 8 hours. I think by law they're required to have 8 hours of battery backup, and then they're relying on diesel power generators to run the pumps to keep their emergency cooling measures intact, you know, when the grid is down. So, mm-hmm. you know, and how easy is it to have an event that disrupts traffic? You know, just like you hit in Japan, a tidal wave,
yeah.
right? All the roads destroyed, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, boom, now the countdown begins. And a big grid failure based on an EMP or solar activity would potentially cause the meltdown of dozens, if not hundreds, of plants on the scale of Fukushima. So I'll just take this back to what was the wisdom of us deploying that knowledge? And you know, it just kind of goes to this thing about the technology itself is just one part of the pie. You know, the social acceptance, the wisdom of its use, the, you know, environmental impact, such and such, a lot of things that go into the equation, makes for a lot of interesting thought and a lot of needed thought from people who are willing to think deeply on these topics.
Well, yeah, I wonder where the thought process was when they built a lot of these reactors, and we have ours like San Onofre and some of these other ones. They're on right on top of the same fault line that Fukushima is on. You know, they're sitting right on top of the fault line. They're on the coast, you know, on a fault line, ready to go. And a lot of these things are leaking and they know it, and they've been covering up for quite some time. And then they generate so much waste that's going to be deadly for the next, you know, 500,000 years or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what kind of the thought process went into this other than pure greed?
I think a lot of it is, James, is it's, look, you know, I'm focused on what is immediately in front of me, which is I got my bills to pay. Here's where my salary to feed my family is coming from. And I can't think about next year, next decade, next century. Because when I'm at the century mark, I'm long gone, all right? And when I'm even beyond that year, I might be in a different job, you know, looking for a different source of material support for my family. And it comes down to a lot of these things. We operate our lives to a large degree with a very short plan, you know? And the more that people are in a fear-based, separation-minded culture, which isn't just, you know, our country. It's the world. I mean, it's the human condition right now. As long as we're in that way, we are going to continue to struggle with exercising the wisdom of foresight. And you know, I do think that there are openings occurring here where more people are starting to get it. You know, it's one of the things I love about the Thrive movie, which I'm sure, you know, you've seen. And if any of the listeners have not seen the Thrive movie, I really think it's a pretty solid and exceptional production that outlines a lot of the big picture issues and some of their solutions, you know, but I do see that movie, the Thrive movie itself, it's symbolic of the fact that there are openings occurring and people are starting to connect, starting to, you know, consider these longer term, you know, implications, as well as a lot of needed, you know, the short term triage that's required to suture up so many of the deep wounds that have been inflicted on us.
Oh, yeah. I think one thing about the Thrive movie is interesting because I went down there and I gave 2 days of on camera talking, you know, about the higher, you know, the evolution we're going through, what we need to do, what we need to turn around the planet, how we need to, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's spiritually and technologically advanced off-worlders that will assist us, you know, in cleaning up our environment, and they know how to live, you know, under universal law or universal principles that are necessary for a healthy society and environment. Unfortunately, that got taken out, and basically they just have me holding a bubble on there.
I saw the very brief piece there. I'm glad that you got in there, but I mean, James, there could have been, you know, a 10-hour movie on, you know, all of the stuff that occurred at your ranch and its implications as well, you know.
I was just hoping they would actually put a link in there. You know, they have Greer all over the place, and you know, it'd be nice if they just put a link in there to the Eseti Ranch so people could go forward with that, or if they just put some footage up on the side of that, just amazing footage of those massive light ships flying over and doing all kinds of turns and things like that that we have, especially some of the recent footage. But, you know, maybe if enough people email them and say, hey, you know, we want to see more, you know, we want to see the footage of the ships, we want to see, we want a link or something, maybe they'll do it. But
that'd be great. And you know what, I think Foster Gamble and the folks working with them, they're open to that type of input. I know like my co-author Jean Manning, she had an hour-long interview with Foster last week, and another close colleague just this week. You know, I think that this is a good, this is going to be a good and increasingly powerful tool that is receptive to suggestions like that. Because, you know, that is, for people to be able to go onto a website like that and you know, just click on a link and see some of the videos that you got, you know, that has, you know, that's a pretty heavy hitting thing right there.
Oh yeah. So, and you know, it kind of gives people hope, like, hey, there are overseers, there are advanced beings out there, you know, we're not alone in the universe. And you know, it really does. It's amazing when I see people, when they see this footage or just hear a little bit of the information, they go, wow, I'm not crazy. You know, I knew this was real. And then they see it actually before their eyes, you know, just like so many thousands of people have come up here and had a total transformation in consciousness and direction. You know, it would do the same thing there, but hopefully, I don't know. I've mentioned it. I haven't gotten any feedback, so I don't know what's going on with that.
Yeah.
But I am far outside the box, you know. It's, I think they're trying to gear this to a more conservative audience, you know, and not lose any credibility, even though we have, you know, beyond credibility here, you know, with all the witnesses we have.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, we're all kind of walking that line, I think, where, you know, it's important for us to be able to, I mean, I'm in that box, too. You know, because, you know, there's times when I'm meeting with, you know, folks from the U.S. Congress, and then other times, you know, people who are sitting in a meditation circle with me, you know, in anything but conventional circumstances or whatever. I mean, I think we all have to do our best to kind of walk in all worlds and be speaking our truth.
Yeah.
But it also calls for discretion. To know, okay, where is the message that we might impart in its wholeness would be way too much for a certain party to digest, and it ends up actually squandering an opportunity to perhaps get an opening. You know, and I've seen that.
A new movie called Beyond Thrive. You know. and put in the really juicy stuff. You know, there are some movies that are in the works. I'll keep you posted on that, but there are some TV series and things like that about the ranch. You know, it'd be good to have you participate in those. But, you know, after around spring or something, these things are going to start coming into fruition. So
yeah, cool.
I'll be posted on that.
Well, I tell you, I'm always, always happy to be an enthusiastic supporter and I guess you could say a bit of an evangelist of sorts when it comes to recommending to people that they go have their own personal experience. And it's because I had mine. You know,
yes.
That's what I base my testimony on, is that, you know, hey, you know, go see it for yourself, you know, and then make up your own mind. Don't shut yourself down just because someone else, you know, gave an opinion. And go
yeah.
see it. And if nothing else, you're going to meet some really interesting people.
Yeah. And you know, the one thing, too, I want to stress to people that, you know, there are no exclusivities in the world of spirit or God or anything else. And even that includes ETs. There is no exclusivity. Nobody, you know, has the franchise or, you know, there is no official representative of one representative of God or contact with ETs, as many would like to step into those shoes. So be really aware of any exclusivities that are out there and people that are not aligned with unity consciousness and sharing and working together for the betterment of the whole, you know, the people that are trying to create their own little exclusive box and control it, the information, I would be very wary of that. And to me, it's all about doing your own research, as you said. You know, check it out yourself, do your own research, look at the evidence, you know, then make your own decision and have your own personal sightings and contact. You know, don't, and also too, you don't need, you know, the president to tell you these things are real. You know, it's
exactly.
like,
exactly.
yeah, it's like, you know, we have to quit giving, you know, our need for acceptance and approval and the rubber stamp on these other authorities, because they've, you know, let's face it, they're proven liars. You know, they've been lying since the beginning. So, you know, why do you go to somebody who's lied to you again and again and again and seeking the truth? That doesn't make sense to me.
Right. Hey, James, yeah. I know we only have a minute or so left. Would it be all right for me to make a quick reference to my website and book?
That's exactly where I was going to go next.
Okay, great. Please check out New Energy Movement at www.newenergymovement.org. Find out about the charity work that we do there. We welcome your support in any way that you might contribute. And please share the message. And also, as a primary education tool, please consider getting the book Breakthrough Power, How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World. It's an award-winning book. I think you will find it very compelling, and again, please share that. And you can find the book at www.breakthroughpower.net.
Great. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. Any new breakthroughs, just keep us informed, and we'll get them out over the air.
Definitely. Thank you, James. Good work, brother, and we'll be in touch.
All right, that's it. We're out of time, folks. So have a great evening and watch the skies and do your own research. Check into these fuelless energy technologies and what's flying above. Have a great evening.